So my dear brothers and sisters, this is part two of our series. Let me start by sharing my screen. All good?
Yes, all good. Thanks, David.
Excellent. So, brothers and sisters, we're going to consider Hezekiah the Great. And for those of you who weren't with us last week, one of the key things that we wanted to talk about is why Hezekiah is great. And he's great in a number of key areas. And we worked out that there probably are three key areas in which Hezekiah is signally really great. One, we saw last week how great a reformer he was compared with the absolute dissolute behavior of his father Ahaz. He was the polar opposite of everything that Ahaz was. He was a reformer who brought the nation from the brink of disaster all the way back to the closest relationship with their God. And tonight, God willing, we're going to look at him as the great leader, the one who led them through a time of absolute national crisis, a time when everything was going wrong. And we'll see what a great leader he truly was. And then, God willing, next week we'll finish off with the great repenter. So what we had seen last week was that Hezekiah had implemented his reforms, and his reforms were great. He came to power at the time of Passover. He was the man who really came into power just at that time and instituted the great Passover, not only for Judah, as we saw, but also for all of Israel, the tribes of the north that had rebelled and were actually at war with the south. Of course, the Assyrians had taken many of them away into captivity already. But this was the great restoration. And what God granted to Hezekiah was 14 years of restoration and peace. After he had done this, he was able to restore, build, and consolidate the nation of Judah for a period of 14 years, twice seven, obviously highly significant. And God ended up blessing the nation of Judah because of Hezekiah. And it just shows the power of a good leader to lead an entire nation. If there's ever an example to us, brothers and sisters, when we say, what can one person do? Hezekiah is the example of one person doing an awful lot. And one of the key things that I want us to just focus on a little bit tonight is this idea of the Passover. The Passover was such a seminal event in the reign of Hezekiah, and it defined the nation and the way that they observed their relationship with God, that Isaiah makes a point in Isaiah 29 verse 1 of saying, add ye year to year, let them kill sacrifices with regard to the Passover. And we know that they obviously kept the Passover, but Isaiah was at pains to show that every year it was commemorated with extreme vigor and remembrance of the great Passover that he had instituted. The Passover was a key part of the reign of Hezekiah, and it marked his beginning. Obviously, Hezekiah was the king after Ahaz's father. And last week we looked at Tiglath-Pileser III, the Assyrian king who was the great troublemaker during the reign of Ahaz. But Ahaz, of course, kowtowed to him and tried to sue for peace and become a vassal state of Tiglath-Pileser III. And then, of course, there are other kings in between. And the real villain of the piece that we're going to consider tonight is Sennacherib, the king who came two kings after Tiglath-Pileser. He's the real force of evil for Hezekiah. So the Assyrian beast, that great beast, had been looking elsewhere for a period of time. In fact, it was divinely providential that Merodach-Baladan, the king of Babylon in the south, had caused so much trouble to the Assyrians that they were occupied with dealing with things on the eastern side of the Fertile Crescent, so that God gave Hezekiah 14 years of rest as a consequence. It was divinely providential that that happened. And of course, Tiglath-Pileser's successor was Shalmaneser V, and he ended up really routing Israel, getting rid of the last remnants of Israel in the north, the separate tribes in the north. And with all of these, it's interesting to see that they end up having very horrible deaths. They don't see the fulfillment of their ambition. And I believe a lot of that is divinely ordained. Shalmaneser died before his siege was even completed. And then Sargon II was the one who finished off the last of captivity in the north. Israel was carried out of their own land to Assyria, and to this day, the end of the tribes in the north. They were the diaspora from that time onwards. And of course, after Sargon II came Sennacherib, the king that we're talking about. Here's a rock relief on the right of Sennacherib. And they tried to get a reasonable likeness, though, of course, many of them were overly done to try and portray them as supremely royal. He was a very successful king. He was more vicious than any of the ones who had gone before him. If Tiglath-Pileser and the others were nasty, he was many times nastier. And he was very successful at it as well, except against Jerusalem. So this is what his predecessors had done. Out of the north, all the tribes of Israel were deported under the different deportations, Tiglath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, Sargon, and Sargon II deportation. And you look where the 10 tribes of the north ended up, absolutely scattered throughout the Fertile Crescent. A great tragedy, and that's simply because they didn't put their trust in God. What a seminal lesson to the south, to Judah, to do differently. So now we've got Judah down in the south, this last little enclave that was separate. And I remember Ahaz had set himself as a vassal state. And a vassal state obviously was one that really was subordinate to the other king. So Ahaz had originally set Judah as paying taxes and being servile to the king of Assyria in exchange for not being destroyed. But have a look at what the Assyrians had done all the way to the north. They'd set up all of these little vassal states all around, with the exception of Edom and Moab, that were almost self-ruling. And the rest of these were all completely tributary states. They were paying taxes, they were supplying soldiers, they were completely under the sway of the Assyrians. And the last little enclave down here at the bottom is the good king Hezekiah, and he's going to rebel against this heavy hand of the Assyrians. And the Assyrians were mighty people. They were very, very well trained in battle. They had the greatest military machine that the world had seen to that date. They used to have great chariots with massive wheels. They had cavalry and phalanxes of soldiers with long spears. They would come at you almost like a porcupine with all these spears out. So they were an absolutely terrifying menace. In fact, a lot of the soldiers were conscripts from different nations that had been conquered, and they had to show themselves in battle to be good, otherwise they themselves would be put to death. So they were literally fighting for their own lives, even against the Assyrian overlords who had taken them captive. So they were like mercenaries whose life was on the line. But what's really interesting to know at this point, that Judah wasn't the primary target of the Assyrians at this time. Sennacherib was much more interested in the target further down to the south. And this was the area of Egypt that was truly of interest to him. It was all focused on the Nile, and the pharaoh at the time was this pharaoh Shabataka, and that's a bust of pharaoh Shabataka from the Nubian Museum. Now, what's very interesting is that pharaoh Shabataka had his heartland down here at the bottom. In other words, this was the southern part, or as it's also known, Upper Egypt. Upper because it's the upper reaches of the Nile, and that would be Lower Egypt near the Mediterranean. So these were people who were actually in modern-day Sudan. This is modern-day Sudan and Ethiopia over here. These were black pharaohs of Egypt. Really, really interesting. The southern area had become so dominant that they ended up taking over the north, and this was the reign of the black pharaohs over all of Egypt. And what they did is they actually kept the existing Egyptian hierarchy in place, and they added themselves on top of it. In other words, they showed that they were superior even to the existing Egyptian hierarchy, but they let it continue with them as an emperor almost over the kings of Egypt. Incredibly powerful warriors from the south, from Kush, Ethiopian of extract, and southern Sudanese in today's world, and really powerful rulers, incredibly good warriors, and they would train incredibly hard. For example, they would force their warriors to run great distances to make them battle ready. So the Egyptians were a force to be reckoned with. But this is what really would have attracted Sennacherib. The wealth of Egypt far exceeded the wealth of Judah. So the real attraction was the cloth, the linen, the grains that were grown in Egypt, and of course the treasures of Thebes and Memphis, the two key cities. And these are all treasures from around about that time. But what's interesting, Pharaoh Shabataka didn't actually reign that long in today's story. His nephew took over, and the pharaoh was called Taharqa, or as we find in our Bible, he's called Tirhaka, and that's a bust of him. Interestingly, they were all clean shaven by comparison with the Egyptians, who liked to have that pointy beard that came out from their chin. So obviously one of the black pharaohs as well. And here he's actually referred to in Isaiah 37 verse 9. Now Sennacherib received a report that Taharqa, the king of Cush, interesting. You see, they recognized that the power was actually from the south, Cush, not Egypt proper. So it was the southern part, but he was ruling over all of Egypt. He was certainly pharaoh of all of Egypt, was marching out to fight against Sennacherib. When he heard it, he sent messengers to Hezekiah. So this was the pharaoh who was in charge at the time of Sennacherib. And Sennacherib really wanted to get control of that area. And these, just a little aside, these pharaohs, these black pharaohs of Egypt at the time were so powerful that they were a real thorn in the flesh to Assyria. And ended up being a great temptation to Judah to go and make sure that these people were on their side against the Assyrians. Such a powerful warrior nation, of course you want them on your side. But here the prophet Isaiah had something to say. Isaiah 20 at verse 4 to 6. So shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians prisoners. So they're not going to remain as lead. And the Ethiopians captives, young and old, naked and barefoot, even with their buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. In other words, the end of that dynasty was going to come. Isaiah foretold it. And they, referring to Judah who trusted in them, shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and of Egypt, their glory. So what was happening? People in Judah were so taken in by the power of Egypt under these kings that they wanted them as their expectation and their glory. And Isaiah says, you're going to be ashamed. And here they are taken off into captivity. Look at their feet, manacled. And we know it was them because this was the carving that actually spoke of the kings of Egypt being taken by the Assyrians. Notice too, all of them are clean shaven. So Taharqa and his army were really powerful. They actually thumped the Assyrians in an outright battle in 673. And then Esarhaddon marched again against Egypt to try and have a go at them again. Didn't quite succeed. And only much later did Ashurbanipal finally defeat Taharqa in 667. And he managed to escape and went all the way down to the southern city of Thebes, and he died there. And the city was finally sacked, and the gold and the treasures taken back to Syria. So the Assyrians had a long memory, and this was the interest that Sennacherib certainly had to the south of Judah. Now, Hezekiah knew all of this. He was a great leader. He had come to power at the age of 25. Now he was 39. He had had 14 years of peace. And look what Isaiah says he did. Isaiah says, "And thou, Hezekiah, didst look in that day to the armor of the house of the forest. You've seen also the breaches of the city of David, the places in the wall that were broken, how you've gathered together the waters of the lower pool. You've numbered the houses of Jerusalem, and the houses have ye broken down to fortify the wall." He actually knocked down some houses to make a thicker wall, and the wall was more than 3 or 4 meters thick in places. It was one of the most robust walls that you could imagine. "Ye have also made a ditch between the two walls for the water of the old pool." So he did a couple of things. He made military equipment, because remember, the Assyrians were really good. He made great reinforcements to all the walls, not only thicker, but he added a lot of towers to them. And remember what had happened in the reign of one of his predecessors, Uzziah. There was the earthquake in the reign of Uzziah, and many of the walls had been shaken and broken in places, and they were unrepaired until this time. So Hezekiah goes and makes sure all these walls are sturdy and proper gates and towers are installed. And then, of course, he builds this wonderful tunnel known as Hezekiah's Conduit, and I'll play you a little video of that at the moment. But the key thing to show here is that Hezekiah, even though he trusted in God, did something. He did it. He did his part, and then he rested in God. And if that's a lesson to us, my dear brothers and sisters, in trust, it means we do have to bring our part when we want to show ourselves faithful to our Father. Hezekiah did. He did his part. But then the great thing is, after he had done his part, he could hand over to God completely and let God undertake for him. So the walls were built up. He put these wonderful gatehouses in place over vulnerable areas that made it very hard for people to come in just with a single door. They had four entries, so it made it very hard for you to be able to run troops into an area of the gatehouses. So this is some of the original wall that he would have built. And of course, he also had to prepare for revolt, because the second most important city right over here was Lachish. And Lachish was a great fortified city before the Assyrians had installed their own governor there by the name of Pali. And Hezekiah got rid of Pali and installed a governor called Zedekiah there as his governor. And because it was really on an important part of the trade route down to the south. And he pushed back, as we saw last week, the Philistines out of their territory, the Edomites, and he expanded and consolidated the area of Judah, including putting all these royal collection points in and distribution centers throughout the Judean highlands. So he put a lot of effort into his preparation. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play you a video. Colin, tell me if there are any issues with it, but I have shared the sound. Thank you. incredible feat of engineering. Absolutely amazing. And it was not only important for water, it was really important for another reason. It was for one of safety. Because if the Gaihon spring had been left open, it would leave a very important channel back into the city. And this channel was the one that Joab had used many years before when the Jebusites inhabited the city. It's called Warren's Shaft, after the man who discovered it. When they would come in via the Gaihon spring, crawl up this Warren's Shaft, and they would be inside the city. And of course, by covering up the Gaihon spring, in fact, he did it just not with rocks, but an entire gate structure, that there was nothing to be had in terms of the Gaihon spring for the Assyrians. So Sennacherib sweeps down. He comes down the coastal plain and he brings his massive army with him. But he decides he's going to split it. And the reason why he splits it is for two reasons. One, he's heard of this exploratory force from Egypt coming up. And it seems that there was a battle over here, somewhere sort of to the west of Jerusalem. So he splits half of his force to see to this exploratory expedition. And also he has to take then, of course, Libna and Lachish down in the south, the key cities. And then he has another set of his soldiers off to Jerusalem. So around about 200,000 troops under Sennacherib himself to face off against the Egyptians and see to Lachish. And then about another 200,000 under Tartan to go and take Jerusalem. Now, Tartan was one of his generals, that's possibly his name. But Tartan actually wasn't a proper name, it was a title. So you would get a Tartan on the left and a Tartan on the right of the Assyrian king. And that they were viewed as the two ICs, the second in charge for Sennacherib. So he really placed a lot of trust in his military generals on either side. And of course, the Assyrians were brutal. They had all the right weaponry, they had all the right skills, and they were men really trained in war, and they had every reason to fight. They were expansionists, and they had been very, very victorious and successful. So what we've got here is one of the engravings that was, or carvings into the rock relating to Lachish and the inscription that was placed there. And look what Sennacherib says. Sennacherib, the mighty king, king of the country of Assyria, sitting on the throne of judgment before the city of Lachish, I give permission for its slaughter. Absolute brute. Not, you know, let's see whether we can get peace. I give permission for you to finish it. And here we've got the siege engines. There's a siege engine going up the ramp, you know, protected mechanically. They're the wheels and these big battering rams up the front. They broke through the key walls of Lachish. And then what ended up happening is, and it was, Lachish was really well fortified. The populace fled to the other side of the city and tried to get out there, but they were met by the Assyrians on the other side. And if you have a look at the remnants of it today, you can actually find this ramp is still there, and it was made by Sennacherib. And the remnants of the ramp are still there in the earth today. So think they moved all of this earth manually to get at Lachish. They had a lot of patience for what they wanted. And here are the Jewish prisoners. Notice they've got their beards. So these are the men and women of Judah who were taken captive. And here are the Assyrians. And the Assyrians would treat them terribly. They would take a spear and just poke their eyes out. They would put vicious hooks in their nose and just pull them along on the ground. They would flay their skin off their bodies while they were alive. They delighted in torture and cruelty to people. So these people are all supplicants to the king. They're all begging for mercy before the king. Isn't this terrible? God's people begging for mercy before a pagan king. And here you've got a great tragedy. There's a father carrying something on his shoulders, and the mother and somebody else on a cart with a little baby on her lap and a little child behind her, with all their worldly possessions on some cart, heading off thousands of kilometers into an unknown future in Assyria. So Sennacherib was a terrifying man. He was successful, he was powerful, he was brutal, he was cruel. And this was the force that had come against good King Hezekiah. Now in the days of Hezekiah, we saw in that video he had done a couple of things. He had extended this wall outward to protect the flow of Gihon, so this was a new wall. And I also want you just to notice too, here's the temple precinct at the top, and just to the south of it are the royal quarters where the king would live. So the king was abutting the temple complex. He would go up to the temple from his house. It was on the southern part of the slope. And of course, there's the Pool of Siloam at the bottom to provide water for the city. What's interesting to notice is the population of the city was only 25,000. You know, 25 high schools worth of people, if you had to try and imagine it. Or alternatively, if you had to take a stadium of about this size, you know, a small football stadium, 25,000 people would fit into a stadium like this. But that's people, men, women, and children. So if you work out how many fighting people, soldiers, could be in the city of 25,000, at best, 10,000. Those stands would be 10,000. That's the total fighting populace that Jerusalem had under the days of Hezekiah. This is what they were stacked against. This is Super Bowl in the United States, and the stadiums carry 100,000 people each. Two Super Bowls next to each other. Imagine every one of these an Assyrian soldier. It was that against that. Or if you had to think of it another way, for every one soldier in Judah, you know, not really well trained in battle. Sure, they had pushed back the Philistines, but not vaguely with the same military prowess as the Assyrians. One soldier in Judah would have to face off against 20 trained Assyrian soldiers with the best equipment. Bloodthirsty, motivated. Terrible odds. Absolutely horrible odds. And we know the Assyrians were extremely successful. Whatever cities they were up against, they would wait their time and they would wear them down by siege, by battering rams, as you see over here, and by cruelty. And they got their way. In fact, it was so bad in Judah, scripture tells us that 46 cities had already fallen to the Assyrians. 46. 200,000 people had gone into captivity. A vast number of Judah just taken away. Nearly 10 times the population of Jerusalem gone off to Assyria. Jerusalem's the last one left. The last one left. What are the odds of all of this working out right? See, and this is where the difference is between having the mind of the spirit and the mind of the flesh. Because according to the mind of the flesh, like Ahaz, his father, there was no chance at all of survival. So this is the key two verses of tonight's talk, where Hezekiah shows what a great leader he was. So he had started with preparation. After his preparation, he knows it's up to God. So now it's all about faith and focus and encouragement. He's done all he could. Now he puts it in God's hands. So in 2 Chronicles 32, verses 7 to 8, he says, "Be strong," and the word there is literally a play on his name, the strength of Yah. Be a little Hezekiah. Be strong and courageous. The words that Moses used with Joshua. "And be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him. For there be more with us than with him. And of course, you know, as the little red block shows, he was probably alluding to what Elisha was able to see through the mind of faith at Dothan in 2 Kings 6. He was able to see the unseen multitude who are with the true Israel of God. And with Sennacherib, who's there? Nothing but the arm of flesh. But with us is Yahweh our God to help us and to fight our battles. So these are seminal verses for us, brothers and sisters. We have to be strong and courageous in the face of great odds in this world. Things that take us away from the truth and wear us down and are seemingly insurmountable problems, this entire world and all of its issues. Don't be afraid or dismayed, because Hezekiah says they're more with us than with the arm of flesh. Yahweh is there to help us to fight our battles. And what's so fantastic about this? The people knew the odds themselves. You know how they knew that those other cities were gone, by the way, those 46 cities? They used to do fire signals at night. They would light fire signals at predetermined times, and you would look out and the light would go around from one to the other and you would know that city was all right. And one by one, all the little lights went out around Jerusalem. So at nighttime, they were in the dark all by themselves. Despite all of that, these people rested themselves on the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. That's the power of a great leader. He absolutely believed it himself, and he was able to bring along the entire ecclesia with him. That's true ecclesial leadership, if ever there was one. And there's a lovely verse in Psalm 4, verse 8, which I think is very relevant. I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Yahweh, only makest me to dwell in safety. What other safety is there really other than the one in which we put our trust in Yahweh, our God? There is none. He's the only true safety for all of us. Or this other verse that I'm sure Hezekiah believed, Joshua 23, verse 10. One man of you shall chase a thousand, for Yahweh your God, he it is that fighteth for you, as he hath promised you. So you might be 20 to 1 outnumbered, but those are good odds in terms of Joshua 23, verse 10, because Yahweh is fighting for you. There are 1,000 dots on the screen. One of you will chase 1,000 if you trust in God. Hezekiah patently believed all of this. Isaiah says of this time that I will fasten him as Hezekiah as a nail in a sure place. He was the anchor for their faith. And he shall be for a glorious throne to his father's house, the father David, not Ahaz. And they shall hang upon him, because he's reliable, all the glory of his father's house, the offspring and the issue. He was trustworthy for the future. We know this is messianic as well, obviously. But it certainly applied to Hezekiah, because he was solid in his faith for his God. So the people trusted in Hezekiah because Hezekiah trusted in his God. And one would think everything would be fine, wouldn't one? We would think, if you did all of this with that level of faith, all would be well. But there's a principle that plays out large in this entire circumstance with Hezekiah, and it's that of an untried faith being an unreliable faith. What that means is he had faith, but God wants to test it. Not for God's sake, mind you. For our sake, our faith is tried. God's not trying to test to see whether we make the grade, because we always fail. He wants to put our faith under trial to see whether we can see how reliable faith is in our approach to God for the future. So he puts us under stress and tests that faith. An untried faith is an unreliable faith. So this is what happened. In those days, Isaiah says, was Hezekiah sick unto death? And Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amoz, came unto him and said unto him, thus saith Yahweh to the faithful man, set thine house in order, for thou shalt die and not live. One's faith could plummet. You could say, God, I did everything for you and for this Judah, and I put my trust in you. And you simply say, you're going to die and not live. That was not Hezekiah. So this trouble was compounded. Not only were the Assyrians with that mighty army at the gates, but we know that he became terminally ill. Isaiah 38 tells us, thus saith Yahweh, I will deliver thee and this city. So what I'm trying to show here is that these two things happened simultaneously. It wasn't just one set of trouble. Trouble often comes, as some people say, in threes, but that's superstition. Trouble is often compounded to put the extra pressure on us. I will deliver thee and the city. Or if you have a look in 2 Kings 18, Hezekiah was 29 years reigning in Jerusalem. And then the 14th year of his reign, did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah. So if you put this on a timeline, we know he was 25 years old when he began to reign. We've just really reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. We know it was in the 14th year of his reign that Sennacherib came up. And we know he was granted a 15-year extension of his life. And of course, 14 plus 15 make up the 29 years of his reign. So what this is telling us is that his sickness to death and invasion were absolutely concurrent. They happened at the same time. You don't pick that up in just reading the narrative. You have to go between all the verses to find this. It happened at the same time. And not only that, but the third issue compounded. It seems that Rabshakeh was probably a renegade Jew who had run over to the other side to save his skin and for money. He was a great orator and he could certainly speak Hebrew very well and knew all the intonation of Hebrew. And he started this fourfold attack. And of course, it came in waves, so we can't do the detail of the waves. But there was a fourfold attack. And these are the four things he really worked on to get to the people. He said, you're going to be isolated. Egypt's not going to help you. Stop thinking that those great warrior kings of Egypt are going to help you. They're not. You're isolated. And by the way, Yahweh's not going to fight for you because he's angry with you. So now there's doubt. Then he says, well, do you think you stand a chance? Nobody else has. What are the odds? 46 cities have gone. 200,000 people in captivity. And you think you're going to win? And by the way, if you surrender without a fight, you know, Assyria is not that bad as a place to live. That was the third compounded problem that Hezekiah had to face when he was dying himself and the enemy was at the gates. So what happens? Something happens in his name, and I'll expand on that in a moment. In 2 Kings 18, verse 14, these words are said to the Assyrians, to Sennacherib. I have offended. Return from me, go away. That which thou puttest on me, what do you require of me? What do you need of me? I will bear it. In other words, tell me the price, and I'll pay it. Hezekiah, we know at this time, is on his deathbed. So one of the politicians, Shebna, the scribe, led a delegation in Hezekiah's name. Sennacherib didn't know Hezekiah was on his deathbed. It wasn't good to tell him that either. So Shebna went in the name of the king. And the price was 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold, 55 million rands worth in today's money of gold and silver. Where do you have that lying around? Well, strip it out of the temple. The temple that had been restored and built up as the place of worship to God, stripped. to pay the filthy Assyrians. So this delegation comes back as heroes to Israel. You know, very much like, you know, at the beginning of the Second World War, when Neville Chamberlain had gone to Munich to speak to Hitler and come back and waved when he landed at Croydon Aerodrome, and he waved the piece of paper and he said, "Peace in our time." Of course, there was going to be no peace, but everybody loved it. They thought it was true. And exactly the same thing happened here. Jerusalem burst out into a drunken orgy. This is what they said. Isaiah says, this is what the people ran about doing. "Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die." But what that means is, we're going to die tomorrow, not today as we had feared. It's postponed. Our death is postponed. Let's have a party. They became like the vile ones that Isaiah had cursed before, as the vile drunken priests. And just because they couldn't trust the Assyrians, a little bit afterwards, they sent off another delegation off to Egypt looking for help. And Isaiah details it in those verses I've put there. They sent off beasts of burden full of gold and treasures off to Egypt as plan B. None of this sounds like Hezekiah at all. Not the Hezekiah we know. They were doing these things in the name of the king. It's very important when we read this record that we realize this is not Hezekiah. This is the delegation that was led by Shebna. What was Hezekiah to do? He's terminally ill, and these three great problems are weighing on him, and he can do nothing about it. God often reduces us to this position, my dear brothers and sisters, for the same response that Hezekiah would have. In 2 Kings 20, verses 2 to 3, "Then he," that's Hezekiah, "turned his face to the wall and prayed unto Yahweh, saying, I beseech thee, O Yahweh, remember now how I have walked before thee in truth and with a perfect heart, and have done that which is good in thy sight. And Hezekiah wept sore." Now, at first reading of that, you might think Hezekiah was interested in his own good. He was petulant and turning his face to the wall. It couldn't be further from the truth. Hezekiah wasn't even praying for himself. His prayer was actually modeled on the promise that God himself had given to Solomon in 1 Kings 9, verses 1 to 5. And that promise was, "If you walk before me correctly, I will preserve you." His appeal was for those promises that were made to David and Solomon to be repeated through him, because at that time he had no heir. And he realized that the nations would look at God and say, "Your promises to David and Solomon have failed." This prayer of Hezekiah was not for his own salvation. It was God-centered, for the principles that God wanted in the earth for his promises. He is an incredible man. How many of us, with these three problems facing imminent death, would be praying for God's promises and not our own skin? This is the house of the king to the south of the temple. And here's the approach to the temple. And of course, there were steps up to it. So you can imagine Isaiah having told Hezekiah this bad news. In 2 Kings verses 20, verses 4 to 5, "It came to pass before Isaiah was gone out into the middle court," he had hardly left, "that the word of Yahweh came to him, saying, Turn again and tell Hezekiah, the captain of my people." There he was, the great leader, the captain of my people. "Thus says Yahweh, the God of David, thy father." You see, there's the link to the promises to David and Solomon. God heard the prayer of Hezekiah, and he knew why he was praying it. "The God of David, thy father, is the one who's answering. I've heard your prayer. I've seen your tears. Behold, I will heal thee. And on the third day, thou shalt go up to the house of Yahweh." You're going to go back to the temple. You who were ceremonially unclean because of your putrefying sores that were malignant and killing you. You will go up to the house of Yahweh on the third day. 3 days for healing? Think about the significance of that. So in 2 Kings 20, verses 8 to 11, Hezekiah says to Isaiah, "What shall be the sign that Yahweh will heal me and that I shall go up to the house of Yahweh the third day?" This was no doubt on the part of Hezekiah. This is not him doubting God's word. He was saying, "When shall I know I'm ready to go to the house of Yahweh, when I shall be ceremonially clean, not like I am now, tainted by death?" His heart was in the house of Yahweh. A wonderful view of this man. Isaiah said, "This is the sign you're going to have from Yahweh. Yahweh will do the thing that he has spoken." And then he asks him a question. "Will the shadow go forward 10 degrees? And by the way, when you read degrees in scripture, degrees always is the Hebrew word for a flight of steps. It's not degrees as we know on a compass. It's flights of steps. Or go back 10 degrees. So it must go up 10 markings on the steps or go back 10 degrees. Hezekiah answered, "It is a light thing for the shadow to go down 10 degrees. So if the sun is setting, for it to continue setting. But let the shadow return backward 10 degrees. So he's wanting God to confirm it for him. Isaiah the prophet cried unto Yahweh, and he, Yahweh, brought the shadow 10 degrees backward by which it had gone down in the sundial of Ahaz." Yahweh performs this miracle. And there's a great clue in that as to what happened. So here's a representation of what the sundial of Ahaz was. Remember, the king's house was to the south and lower, and here was the temple. Now, either a pole or a building was the marker in the middle. So say at 6 a.m. in the morning, the sun would be low in the sky, and there would be a marker on the steps here as 6. When it was 1 p.m., you'd have a marker somewhere over here, for example, and later in the afternoon when the sun was going down about 4 p.m. This is why I think this happened with Isaiah as the shadows were lengthening. And think about that as an ominous thing for Hezekiah. The shadows are darkening, the night is drawing on, and his life is fading away. If the sun had just continued to go down, where would the sign be? But he wants it to go backwards. How could this have happened? How could the sundial sun appear to go backwards? God didn't shift the earth. And you know what? It only happened on the sundial of Ahaz, on this structure. The way it would happen, I believe, is that God's Shekinah glory appeared. And the glory of God outshone the sun, so that the shadow was completely erased and looked like it was 6 a.m. once again. And think about that. This has happened before. Or it happened much later, obviously, chronologically. But we know scripturally it's happened in the sense of Saul on the road to Damascus, where the glory of God outshone this midday sun. So I've created a little video here to try and show you this happening. Have a look at the normal sun. And then here's the normal dial. And watch how the sundial can be moved backwards. Imagine Hezekiah watching as it moves back and back. And you can see it's localized as the glory of God appeared just for Hezekiah. And when it was finished and Yahweh's glory went back, the sundial continued on its way. So it gets rid of all of those crazy stories about God shifting the sun around and everything else. It was a great story. It was a great way of showing practically to Hezekiah that Yahweh was with him. The Shekinah glory of Yahweh was with Hezekiah. So what became of Sennacherib and his army? We're drawing to a close now. Don't worry, we won't be too long. What happened to Sennacherib and his army? His fate was absolutely sealed because of two things. One, of Rabshakeh and all the vile things that Rabshakeh had said about God. And secondly, the own letter, is the own writing of Sennacherib himself that he had sent personally to Hezekiah to rail against God. And so testimony to this man, he's just been healed from death. And he takes all of this and he doesn't feel strong. He takes it to the source of all comfort and he lays it out before God. And he wants God to solve this issue. He's upset because these people rail against, as we read in 2 Chronicles 32, rail against Yahweh, God of Israel, just like David was upset with what Goliath was doing. And they speak against him, Yahweh. They spoke against the God of Jerusalem. That's what really got to Hezekiah. He sent off his men to go and seek the prophet Isaiah. And in sackcloth and ashes, both Hezekiah and Isaiah, it says, for this cause, for this reason, because they were against God, Hezekiah the king and the prophet Isaiah prayed and cried to God in heaven in sackcloth and ashes because of his holy namesake. This is the quality of Hezekiah. And this is the swift response by the hand of Isaiah. Yahweh responds directly. You see, when our lives are aligned to God, Yahweh responds as he did to the prayer of Hezekiah the first time. Here's Yahweh's response. Be not afraid of the face, in the Hebrew, of the words which thou hast heard. Don't worry about the face of Sennacherib, with which the servants of the king of Assyria have blasphemed me. Don't worry about them. I am sending a spirit, an angel, against him, and he will hear tidings of the destruction of his army. Remember, he was separated from them, more at Lachish, to the coast. And he will return to his own land empty-handed and will cause him to fall by the sword in his own land. And what Yahweh says always happens. So in a single moment, a single angel descended on the camp of the Assyrians. And 185,000 prime soldiers were lying dead with one angel. To 185,000. And we know that it was in the 14th year of his reign. When that happened, it was Passover. Isn't that fascinating? The Passover was so important to Hezekiah. And the angel of death passed over all of Judah to save them and smote the camp of the Assyrians at Passover. Sennacherib bragged on his many, many tablets and prisms that he wrote of all his conquests. He lied about what happened to Hezekiah, that he had victory over him, and he plainly didn't. This is in the British Museum, literally dictated by Sennacherib. And in 2 Kings 19, verse 37, we read, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. He went back without nearly 200,000 soldiers. It wasn't a good thing for him. And of course, he worshipped his gods. These great temples that were built with these bull, man, mixed creatures. And we read from Scripture in 2 Kings 19, verse 38. Remember what Isaiah prophesied? It came to pass as he, Sennacherib, was worshipping in the house of Nisroch, his god. And there's Nisroch, this bird-headed god. That Adrammelech and Sherezer, his sons, smote him with the sword. Exactly what Isaiah had said. And they escaped into the land of Armenia. And Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. And that's possibly the face of the criminal who did that to Sennacherib, one of his sons. And this on another carving is the funeral procession for the death of Sennacherib. And he was no more. That great threat was vaporized by Yahweh. So twilight then fell on the reign of Sennacherib. That was the end of him. But a beautiful new dawn arose for Hezekiah and Judah, a time of healing and restoration once again. But it certainly wasn't without its risks. And we'll look at that, God willing, next week, when we look at what happened with Hezekiah after this time of great redemption. And we see him in a great role as a repenter to Yahweh. So we'll do that, God willing, next week. Thank you very much.